anyway, Aidan Ilana has just run into the studio. You've got a book in your hand, ain't it? Must be a good one, another book.
I have a lovely book called Insect Portraits that's written by Lisa Clancy. And in fact, I must confess an interest because I have written one of the bun moths for it. There are three people saying wonderful things about it on the front page. Myself, Eric Dempsey and Megan Nolan. So we're all in good company. Mm. So now I have the book and I interviewed Lisa Clancy about the book. I couldn't do it live on air tonight because it wasn't suitable for everybody. So I actually did it last Tuesday.
Very good.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I really was delighted with this book because I'm fierce busy at the moment. Everybody's wanting me to give talks here and talks there, and it's Heritage Week and it's Biodiversity Week and it's every blinking week. And as a result, I'm introduced to vast audiences of people as an entomologist, which, of course, is not true. I am a botanist. My degrees and stripes are all in botany rather than in insects.
You better explain the difference, Aina.
Well, entomology is the study of insects.
Indeed.
And botany is the study of plants. Now, obviously, there's a great connection between the insects and the plants because we need the insects to pollinate plants so that they have seeds and reproduce and all the rest of it. But in my day, when I was getting my stripes, we never looked at an insect at all. We were just interested in the plants bare and baldy. But however, obviously, my love of insects must emanate from my pores because I'm being introduced as an entomologist. Probably why I was asked to write some kind of a little frontispiece for this as well.
Well, I have the book in my hand as well, and you, Lisa Clancy, it's a lovely book. It's a great cover, I have to say. You're quoted on the cover and you say, astounding pictures. Aidan Ilana, author of the great Irish biodiversity book. And the pictures really are fantastic in this book. In fact, they are making insects appealing for the first time for me, at any rate.
Yeah, because what she has done is she has focused on the eyes are the windows of the soul. And if you take pictures of people, we always look at their eyes. But insects have completely different eyes to human eyes. They have these compound eyes with all the little bits in it. And the eyes have it, as I say, in this book. There's huge eyes, tiny eyes, round eyes, triangular eyes, multifaceted eyes, rainbow-coloured eyes, stripy eyes, invisible eyes, even eyes that like black holes.
The eyes have it, Aina. The eyes have it. But at any rate, you spoke to her last week.
So I spoke to her last week and I started off by saying to her, it's not just a book of lovely pictures of insects all the same, though, is it?
Hi, Aina. Hi. Lovely to talk to you. Thanks for having me on. It's kind of got two angles to it. It's a macro photography book, but with a kind of a different angle. It's looking at insects, showcasing them in their grandeur. I typically use like portrait photography techniques, you know, light coming from different angles. And I really like to shoot them from underneath, as you'd see in portrait photography, really just to showcase their beauty. I think we're very used to looking at photographs of insects looking down on them. So I really wanted to show their beauty because they can be really beautiful. And then the other aspect of the book is, and I really wasn't expecting this at all, but I just wanted to write one or two statements about each of the subjects. And then that just opened up an avenue I was not expecting. As you probably know yourself, they are endlessly fascinating. And that's actually been the most enjoyable part of the book now, has been researching them and bringing their stories to light. That's really what it is.
It's a lovely read, I have to say, because you have done two strange things, I think, for a book. Normally, when you get a book, you look at the picture and then you read about it. Whereas what you have done is you have taken wonderful pictures, really nice pictures of insects, and then the text. It's something interesting you've found out about the insect rather than anything the way you would normally get in a book saying this insect is such and such a size and such a place and such a thing. You don't care about that. You want to tell us something really interesting about this so that we go away saying, God, I never knew that. And I have to say, you do it exceedingly well.
Thank you so much. Yes, definitely. I prioritised the things that fascinated me the most, even if they didn't truly reflect what was shown in the photograph. I just, once I read something, I thought, I have to share this. Like, for example, dishonest sexual signaling in insects really grabbed me. This idea of males and females of a species falsely advertising their quality to each other. I don't know if you read the one about the daggerfly and how during courtship, the male will present a nuptial gift to a female, which is typically a dead insect. And this is an ancient behavior that evolved at a time before flowering plants. And then when flowering plants came along, suddenly there was this cheap energy source, this nectar. And as the males started to rely more and more on this energy source, they've sort of partially lost the ability to hunt. So now when they're procuring these nuptial gifts, they're getting injured, they're dying at these very high rates. And they've devise what I think are these comical adaptations to cope with this. So they'll cheat. There's reports of them like fashioning bits of willow seed into kind of a spear shape and presenting it to a female as if it's a gift. And before she's realised what's going on, you know, he's mated with her. They'll steal. If they see another male flying past with a dead insect, they'll just try and hijack it off them. And my personal favourite one, they'll reuse gifts. So they'll, if they manage to get an insect and kill one, they'll present it to the female. She'll suck it dry while he's mating with her, and then he'll take it back and he'll give it to another female. And that sort of stuff just, when I was reading it, it just really, really tickled me. But it's proper adaptation. So I read about certain species that have even evolved to have these projections on their legs that like enhance the appearance of these gifts to kind of further deceive the females. And then, as I was saying, there's they're dying, they're getting injured, and they're dying in these high amounts. So that leads to these highly skewed sex ratios in certain populations. There's far more females to males. And that has led to something rarely seen in nature, which is choosy males and competing females. And so the females have these adaptations to cope with this skewed sex ratios. So one report was females who will suck loads of air into her abdomen so it looks like she's full of mature eggs. So she gets a free meal. Well, hopefully it's not a fake gift. She gets a free meal and he thinks he's mated, but really he's only mated with hot air.
Now, I'm looking at the different pictures that you have. Did you take all of these insects and woodlice and things like that, which aren't insects? Did you take all these pictures in Ireland? Did you see them all yourself, or where did you get some of them from?
I started off, so this has come from a master's thesis from 2009. So I started out in the burn because my parents are from Carfin in County Clare. So I'd hop the wall at the end of their garden and then shot all around the burn. And then I moved to Gort for a few years. So a lot of them were shot around the Gort area. And then 2 years ago, I moved to Ballyban in Galway City. And I'm amazed when I read back over the book at the end, I was amazed at how many I'd actually captured right here in my garden. So yeah, they were all shot in around Galway. I have one photo of a desert locust. I did my PhD on the behaviour of the desert locust, and I really liked that one. So I just kind of stuck that in. You'll notice that the subtitle for the book is Capturing the Personality of Mostly Irish Insects. And that's because, as you said, there's a woodlouse and not an insect. And there's the desert locust, which fortunately hasn't come to Ireland yet.
One of the things I actually found fascinating about your book is that you seem to have caught the eyes of the insects. I mean, we always look at the eyes of other people when we're speaking to them, and eyes are very important communications with humans among each other. But you don't necessarily get so many pictures of eyes of other things. And of course, a lot of the insects, particularly the flies, have huge big compound eyes. In other words, they look like the top of a Waterford glass decanter, that big knob with all the facets on it. And by having your close-up pictures so well taken of the eyes, you're able to see this in very many of the pictures. And this is something that you don't necessarily see in other books on insects at all.
Well, the eyes, as you know, are the windows to the soul, and the same is true for insects. It just kind of happened by accident. I got a few photographs. One in particular stood out. It was a speckled yellow moth. It's a day-flying moth. It was down near Shandangan Loch, just outside Carfin. And it was when I got home and I was looking at my computer, I thought, no offence to Winston Churchill, but it just struck me as this kind of, there was this statesman-like quality to it, and it was the eyeball, had attitude, it was the colours, it was the way it was lit, and that was the spark. Portraits. I want to capture insects as if they're going to be in the National Portrait Gallery, and of course the eyes are absolutely essential for that. And then even one of the stories I've caught in the book is talking about the moth eyeball. So as you probably know, moths have this anti-reflective eyeball. And the prevailing theory is that if they're out flying at night and the moonlight hits their eye, you know, they're going to be more susceptible to predation by bats. So they don't, their eyes don't reflect any light. And when I looked into why this is, it's absolutely stunning. So there's a thing called the corneal nipple array. So on the surface of the moth's eyeball are these teeny tiny nipples. Now, I'm not even going to pretend I understand the physics, but the dimensions of these nipples are smaller than the wavelength of light. So as light is moving through the air, which has a low refractive index, and let's say it hits something with a high refractive index, like glass or something, the transition from low to high is really, really sharp, and that's what causes reflection. But the ingenuity of the moth eyeball, it smooths this transition. So where if light hits glass, it's like falling off a cliff. Whereas if it hits the moth eyeball, because of this corneal nipple array, it's like goes down a gentle slope and it guides all the light down into the eyeball. I read a few analogies because it's quite hard to get your head around. One was saying it's like a pinball machine with these tiny guiders that like pew 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 guide the light all the way down into the moth eyeball. And then another one said it was like a black hole, like it sucks all the light in. That quote was by an engineer who was creating anti-reflective screens. So they've been inspired by the moth eyeball. So if in the future you find yourself with a screen that doesn't reflect any light, you know that they have mimicked what's found on the surface of a moth eyeball, this beautiful geometry, this corneal nipple array. I'm really, really proud of the photographs, and that's what got me into it. And I think they're really stunning and striking to look at. But it's the stories that have drawn me in. One of the ones I found towards the end of the book about this shield bug that I love. She has this organ on her legs, and for years they thought that that was had to do with making sound. But they just discovered last year that it's actually, they discovered what it's for. So as she's moving throughout her environment, she'll gather up fungi. She'll put it into this little organ. And there's these thousands, about 4,000 secretory tubes that feed this organ. So when she puts the fungi in, these tubes sustain and nourish the fungi. So they continue to grow in this organ. And then when it comes time for her to lay her eggs, she'll lay her eggs, and then very delicately. And what I love about modern science is in all the papers now you have supplementary information. So they have videos. So you could just go and watch this. She'll very carefully scrape the fungus out of her organ and very carefully lay it on the eggs. And then it's thought that the eggs have this polysaccharide layer, and that sustains the fungus even further. And it grows and creates this dense shield for the eggs. Now, her eggs are particularly vulnerable to parasitoid wasps. And again, you can watch videos of this. They release a wasp and you can see the wasp flying around and trying to get access to the eggs. And it can't because of this fungus. To me, it's so beautiful because it's kind of relatable. She's using things in her environment to protect her young. And I was just, I've just been awestruck. It's been one of the greatest experiences just to read about these things.
I can't let you go without talking to you about horseflies. You have a wonderful picture of the horsefly, the very number one, with green and black stripy eyes. The eyes actually contain photoreceptor cells that are sensitive to light polarization. So if they see a creature that gives off polarized light, they're in like Flynn, and if it doesn't, then they don't notice it so much. And you say that they don't bite zebras as much as they bite cows and horses, and that if you painted stripes on cows and horses, they wouldn't get bitten so much by the horseflies. Now, if people get bitten by horseflies as well, so should we go around painting ourselves in stripes so that we won't be bitten by horseflies, because there's nothing as painful as a horsefly bite?
First of all, I think what attracted me to that paper about some probably lowly PhD student, because I've been that soldier, out in the field painting cows to look like zebras. It just tickled me. And then that led on to another paper I read, which was looking at ritualistic body painting that you find in Aboriginal communities and tribes in Africa and Indonesia and things like that, a lot of which involve striping. So this author, she made the connection that, yes, it, you know, this body painting could have evolved as a way to deter biting flies. And then that led on to another beautiful story, which was looking at the correlation between the abundance of biting flies and striping in equine species, and found that there is a correlation. Wherever there is a higher abundance of biting flies, there's more likely to be striping in the horse species in that area. Now, I have to say, because I sent this book to my PhD supervisor and he's actually working in this area, and he insisted I add a footnote, which is it's only a theory and there is loads of other theories about why zebra have striping. But one of them is that it is a way for the zebra to deter biting flies. That whole horsefly, that was actually one of the first ones I wrote. Genuinely, what drew me to it was empathising with this PhD student. And a lot of the stories in the book do that. I'm more kind of intrigued by the experimental design than I am than, you know, the outcome of the experiment, because it just I could just imagine I could put myself in the shoes of someone up in the lab.
Well, it's a great read. Thank you very much, Lisa, for expanding on these stories as you have done so inimicably.
Thank you so much, Aina. It was lovely to speak to you.
More details, as always, can be found on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. We'll be back again next week with a special edition of the programme, a highlights package of the Dawn Chorus. Don't miss it. Until then, goodbye, goodbye, goodbye.
And Mooney Goes Wild was presented and produced by Derek Mooney.
Email mooney@rte.ie.
The scene is set in beautiful Bantry, County Cork. The West Cork Literary Festival runs from July 11th to 18th and will include readings, seminars, workshops and children's events. Enjoy legendary West Cork hospitality and meet Emer McBride, Alan Hollinghurst, Carol Drinkwater, Neil Jordan, Vanna Groark and many more. Book now on westcorkliteraryfestival.ie, supported by the Arts Council.
You know that guy I've been seeing?
Yeah?
Turns out my sister's been seeing him too.
Oh, really?
And I heard he's been seeing Siobhan at number 56. And Declan.
Your brother?
Yep.
Specsavers opticians and audiologists own their stores, so your care is their business, which can make them rather popular.
I've got something to tell you. I've got half an hour with him this afternoon.
Specsavers. Your care is our business.
Take a look at our website, rte.ie/Mooney.